Break your leg.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Misun. Well, I really couldn't complain to Kristen, so I complained to Jason. So, thank you for having me at your Pockets of Enthusiasm. Thank you, the committee members. I just want to give you guys a big applause for anybody had anything to do with putting this together. So, I know it's a lot of work. Ralph calls them shadow soldiers. There's always a saying about the meeting makers make it, and I used to think, what does that mean? What does that really mean? Because I know a lot of people who went to meetings but never really got sober. I know a guy that, Charlie, he was always drunk, but he was in meeting every day. And he died drunk. He never got sober. And then I thought about it, and meeting makers are really the making the meetings, who goes and set up the chairs and set up the tables and make the coffee and greet people and set up the literature. They are the making the meetings. And without that, I wouldn't be here. So I don't know. Different times I get different perception and different opinions about things. By God's grace, Program of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I've been sober since January 27th, 1995, and for that, I am truly grateful. And in case you're wondering, I got sober when I was 5. So and thank you for the talks. Jason, stop doing that on your phone. Yeah, if it rings, I'm going to answer it. That was really amazing. That was one of the best talks I heard you. And Julie, thank you for your talk. And and my God, that was interesting panel session thingy. Ralph, it's so good to see you. He's like, Ralph is Ralph. He's like my hero. They always say you can't have heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you know what? Screw it. I have some. So I have a home group. It's called Three Legacies, and we meet at 7 o'clock Wednesday night. And if you're ever in Naples, you're welcome to come. It is an open meeting. And I was just sharing a story with someone. I can't remember who. But it's a kind of new meeting. And somebody came in, and I was like, I was a greeter. It's really hard for me to be a greeter. But somebody said, what does that mean, three legacies? And I said, well, in your case, it'll be me, myself, and I guess. I probably shouldn't have said that. And I don't know why I say these things. It's just, and then I had to make amends. I mean, it's just terrible. Anyway, and we're the only meeting in Naples actually have all 36 principles hanging on the wall. So I'm kind of proud of that. And the reason I have a problem with greeting is like I didn't come up with it. So it seemed like a lot of people came to Alcoholics Anonymous and kind of fell in love with the fellowship. And my sponsor is one of, I have a sponsor. Her name is Polly P, and I know a lot of you know her. And her, she has a sponsor, and her sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor people, and they sponsor people. And I've known Polly for 20-some years, but she wasn't always my sponsor, but I've known her for a really long time. Anyway, the one of the things about people is, I wasn't one of these people who came to Alcoholics Anonymous and fell in love with the fellowship. I did not like that. Like, I was doing great during COVID. So when I was new, they were like in the meetings, they're talking about things like people pleasing, and I didn't know what that meant. So I would look at my sponsor and said, hey, spots, what does that mean, people pleasing? And she will say, in your case, I think you should try it sometime. Go, go try to please someone. For you, it'll be spiritual exercise. That's how, like, I was with people, you know, that fear of people. You know, but I didn't think it was fear. I would tell my sponsors that I'm not afraid of them. I just don't like them, you know. And and then she would, and I don't even know why they were talking about people pleasing and codependency, because it really has nothing to do with our work in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says so in the Dr. Bob's farewell talk. He says that we leave it to, you know, scientific mind, and has very little to alcoholics. But anyways, they're talking about codependency, and I didn't know what that meant. So I look at my sponsor and say, sponsor, what does that mean, codependency? And she's like, well, it's like this. Do you feel bad when people around you feel bad? And I said, no. And she said, okay, you're not codependent, but maybe you're a sociopath. Because, like, you have no empathy. but anyway, that's how I was with people. And I still remember Sandy used to say, I was so afraid of people, but they were everywhere. And it's a problem for people who are so afraid of people. And they're everywhere. And AA is just really bad place to be. so I grew up in Seoul, Korea, under set of parents who were, I told you, they were atheists, and they were, like, all into, like, higher education, and they were not alcoholics. They never drank. They didn't even keep alcohol in the house. I never saw anybody drink alcohol, drop of alcohol. But, like, I wish they had, though. They were a little uptight. Like, if anybody needed a drink, they really needed a drink, but they didn't. They didn't drink. They were not alcoholics. And they were all into, like, you know, educating. They spent basically all their time and energy to trying to educate us and, you know, trying to get us to really good schools. We all had to go to these private schools, and they couldn't really afford it, but we had to, and we had to be number one in the class. And my sisters and my brother was amazing. They were, like, really smart. They all had PhD in something. But I don't. I was very busy trying to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I am left-handed. I'm dyslexic. So I have learning disability, but they didn't know that then, or especially there. And so I wasn't, like, I was reading things backwards, and things didn't make any sense to me. So I just became automatically the dumb one in the house. So, you know, my parents got really frustrated, and they were like, you know, they will, you know, tell me that I was stupid, and, you know, why can't you be like your sister? Or they'd beat me up if I got really bad at scoring tests and stuff like that. I don't know if they thought that they could beat the smart into me, but I'm telling you, that does not work. So that's how I grew up, and I just felt like, okay, I'm the dumb one in the family. I just admitted that, and, you know, I don't want to be here, kind of thing. And when I was 15, my parents shipped me off to a boarding school in North Carolina. And I talk about my childhood to say one most important thing, and that is none of this made me an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. I used to tell my sponsor, I said, I can't be an alcoholic because I'm Asian. and I used to tell her, I have a proof. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I'll turn to page, there's a solution. And it says, we are average Americans. And thank you. And she will say, shut up. And I heard that a lot. But I found out also that Koreans drink 20% more than Irish. Who knew? But anyway, it does not make me an alcoholic. You know, it has nothing to do with how my parents treated me or how they abused me or physically, how my my siblings made fun of me. They called me stupid. It has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. There are a lot of people treated the same way that don't become alcoholics. I'm an alcoholic only because when I take a drink, I get a special effect that does not happen to normal drinkers. And the effect happened to be so special, I would sell my soul little by little in order to take that drink. And when I was 15, they shipped me off to this boarding school in North Carolina. And when I was going there, I was happy to leave home because I knew that nobody's going to call me stupid and nobody's going to beat me up and nobody's going to, you know, chase me down and say, you know, you're dumb, you're whatever. So I was happy to leave home. But when I got there, I had another problem that I didn't think about. I was 15. What do I know? And I couldn't speak English. So I didn't understand what was going on in the classroom. I didn't understand the assignment. I didn't know what the teachers were saying. And most of all, I couldn't make friends. And I remember the cafeteria was about this big. And I would walk into cafeteria with a tray full of food. And when I walk by, I see these kids stand up and walk away because they are afraid that I would sit with them. And they knew that I couldn't talk to them. So they'll stand up and walk away. Except there were a group of kids that sat in the back of the school cafeteria in the round table. And I don't know how this was possible, but maybe it was a North Carolina thing, or maybe it was 1980-something thing. But they were smoking cigarettes in the cafeteria, and they had a boombox. Now, any YPG in here, if you don't know what that is, you could Google it. So, and they were listening to things like The Clash and the Sex Pistols, and one guy had a mohawk and another one dressed like Judd Nelson in Breakfast Club. And the only kids didn't stand up and move away when I came near. They actually let me sit with them. They'll be the only kids that I was actually allowed to sit with and have a meal with. I don't know if they were too stoned to notice me, but I really didn't care. And so I did whatever they did. You know, I started smoking cigarettes. They told me how to smoke cigarettes. It was Lucky Strike unfiltered. Yeah, I'm really cool like that. And I would pretend to listen to The Clash and the Sex Pistols. I don't know what they're saying about, but I remember it kind of annoyed me because I thought it was really loud, but, you know, I had to fit in with these guys. And one Friday, they were super excited about something, and the only thing I understood was no lunch, no dinner. So I didn't eat dinner. I didn't eat lunch. I didn't eat dinner. And what they did when I crossed the campus and snuck into college dorm and bribed some of the college kids and got some alcohol and cigarettes and funny cigarettes. So, and then we went off to a party, and that will be the first time I ever took a drink. And I remember it like it was yesterday. They was just passing this, like, cold beer, you know, and like I told you, I never saw anybody drink. Nobody taught me how to drink. It was just like, anyway, so they gave me this cold beer. I remember it was beer, and I remember it was very cold to the touch. And I don't know where this thought came from. And as soon as it got to my hand, I instinctively knew that I'm supposed to chug it. I'm not supposed to sip it. Now, I was like, my God, that is such a God-inspiring thought. You know what I mean? So I chugged it, and I had a second one probably. And I don't remember how many I had that night, but that's how I drank, you know? It's like I drank until I passed out. Who counts how many you have? I mean, I don't know. But anyway, so I still remember how it made me feel. You know, I don't remember the taste. Some people remember the taste, but I don't remember the taste. I just remember the feeling. I had this tingly feeling all the way down to my fingertips, and apparently when I was drunk, I spoke English. So I am... I'm talking with these guys, I'm cracking jokes, and I'm singing along to all the Sex Pistols songs. I knew all the lyrics, and so it was amazing. Now I'm thirsty. So, from then on, this is something I knew I had to do, you know? And my thought was like, well, I'm in United States, and I have to speak English every day, so I'm going to drink every day. So I just snuck into the college dorm and got some liquor, and, you know, and I eventually learned how to make fake ID. That was a really good old times when you could actually buy alcohol with a fake student ID. Anyway, that's how I spent my high school. And I went off to college in New York, and I landed in Lower East Side, East Village in the 80s. It was so much fun. Oh, my God. I don't really remember going to classes, but apparently I have a bachelor's degree. But I became the party, the club kid person, you know. I went to all kinds of clubs, and I went to after hour clubs, and I went to after hour clubs, and this is where, you know, our other, like, one of my sponsors calls it bottom enhancers came in, and I'm drinking and doing stuff, and I mean, just partying, and I'm having a great time, you know. I didn't think anything wrong with it, and I started having blackouts. I didn't know what that was until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought you just, you know, you passed out and you forgot. I mean, like, I didn't know there was words to it. And and so I would, like, start at one club, and I end up in, I wake up, I go, I'll come to in another club in a bathroom with no shoes on, and I don't know how it happened. And I come to in a taxi cab, and I don't know how that happened. I come to in somebody's apartment, I don't know whose it is, where it is, kind of thing. And, but, you know, those are the consequences, I guess, when people talk about consequences. And that is, that is what happens to me when I drink alcohol. So it's what alcohol does to me. But what alcohol does for me is far greater than what it does to me. So I don't care what it does to me. I'm going to always go for what it does for me. And that is that special effect. And and after college, I went to work for Art World, where I got to travel all over the United States, all over Europe, and installing all this contemporary art, and I thought I was all that. And, you know, the Bill Wilson talks about it. I have arrived. I had that feeling. You know, I was in early 20s, and my God, the museum curators are calling me. It's like, could you come and install this and install that? And they were like, you know, pay me 3 weeks and put me in a hotel, and all this kind of stuff. And it was a really great job and challenging job. But my alcoholism is progressing. And I don't notice it, but other people did. It's so annoying when that happens. And so people start saying things like, what is wrong with you? Well, actually, they still say that, but for different reasons. And you're missing appointments, you're late again, we have an opening, and you didn't do this, you didn't do that, all kinds of stuff. So I thought, you know what? Something's got to give here. So I quit the job. At the time, I thought it was a great idea. And so then I could just party and all by myself, and, you know, like, nobody's going to tell me what to do, and nobody's going to tell me to come to work and all that stuff. And the funny thing is, though, when you don't work, you don't get paid. Oh, my God. Like, I didn't think about that. So my money ran out, and by this time, my alcoholism progressed enough that I couldn't get a full-time job. And so I had this, like, part-time job that I could barely go to. And I am now where, you know, I tell my friends, like, they will say, why do you drink so much? And I will say, why don't you drink so much? And, you know, and I'll say things like, well, you don't understand. Just leave me alone. And I get to a point where they all did leave me alone. And I was just, I couldn't even drink at a bar anymore. You know, I was drinking at home by myself. I had no friendly directions. Nobody would talk to me. I had no friends. And I have no family members because, you know, they're either in Korea or in other states or whatever. And I was barely going to work. And this is when I started to sell my soul little by little. In order to feed my alcoholism, I need to steal and lie and cheat in order to get that drink. Sharon, tell her I say hello, please. I love her. But she would say, I would slide my dignity across the bar for yet another drink, you know, thing. And so I started to do that. I started to lie and cheat and steal in order to get that drink. And mostly they were my friends, and some of them were my employers. And I would, you know, and I had to make amends for that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But one winter night, I was sitting in the apartment. Now I actually sold everything that was in the apartment. It was furnished apartment. They were my furniture, but I sold them. Apparently, that same thing is stealing. Did you know? I didn't know that. God, a lot of things I have to make amends for. It's just like make no sense whatsoever. And I was sitting in this empty apartment. I remember lamp is over here and a 3 garbage can full of my vomit on this side. And I'm just like any other day. I have vodka, I have a stuff, and I'm drinking. And this thought came to me that I never had before. And it said, I don't want to be drunk, I don't want to be sober, I just want to check out. Now, there is a part in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that mentions that, and I think it's in the chapter Vision for You. If it's not, don't come and correct me, please. Just, if you're upset about it, you could just talk to your sponsor. But it says it comes a time where alcoholic cannot imagine life with or without alcohol. They're jumping off place, they wish for the end. See, as an alcoholic, I could always imagine life with it. But I came to a point when I could not. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to be drunk. I just wanted to check out. Now, I didn't know where to get a gun in New York, so I said, well, forget the gun. And then I thought, maybe I'll jump off the bridge. But it's very cold in New York in January, so I thought, I'm not going outside. And then I thought of a couple of my friends who died of an overdose a few months back. So I said, you know what? I could probably do that. I have stuff. I have vodka. So I drank, you know, I had vodka left, and I drank it all, and I took everything I had. I don't even know how much I had, but when I came to, there's a knock on the door, and my sister was standing there. My sister back then used to live in Jacksonville, Florida, and she flew all the way from Jacksonville to New York City and was standing in front of me, and she looked at me, and she said, what were you doing last night? So I told her that I was trying to kill myself, and she said, how are you going to do that? So I told her that, well, I drank the vodka I had, and I took everything I had. And she looked at me with a look of fear, disgust, anger that I will never forget. If I closed my eyes, I could still see that look. And she looked at me, and she said, well, I wish you had taken more, because she'd rather see me dead than the way I looked that day. And what I didn't know, when I was partying in New York, she was going to Al-Anon meetings in Jacksonville, Florida. And those other people told her, which I should have, like, known something was wrong with her, but I didn't know exactly what. Because she was, like, she was the one, you know. She would send me, like, food or money, whatever, you know. One day, when I asked for money, she sent me a meditation book. I said, she's gone insane. And when I was selling everything that was in my apartment, I couldn't sell that book. Nobody wants that crap. I still have that book, by the way. Anyway, so she's been going to Al-Anon meetings, and they are the ones who told her. I said, look, if you want to go get her, go get her. But don't send her to any fancy rehab. You know, it's just a waste of money. And find one of the worst detox, like a Skid Row detox you could find, and put her in there. And after she gets out, to the Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's exactly what she did. I thought at the time that's kind of mean, but I think what they did is really save my life. And they didn't know me, they never met me, but their love for another alcoholic reached me all the way from Jacksonville to New York City and saved my life. And they used to ask her every Wednesday night, because that was her meeting. They used to ask, have you killed her yet? Anyway, so we put stuff in the bag, and then we flew down to Jacksonville. She put me straight to detox. And she gave me some of the change, coins, And she told me to call her every day from detox. They had a payphone to put the money into. Anyway, because we didn't have cell phone back then. Or I don't think he's allowed anyway. So the next day, I called her. And that was January 27th, 1995. And that is my sobriety date to this day. But January 27th is also my sister's birthday, that sister. But I don't know if I knew it or I didn't remember it or I couldn't care less. Overnight, I all of a sudden just became so angry that she put me in there, and I hated her. And I told her so on the phone. I didn't wish her happy birthday. I didn't thank her for saving me. I told her that how much I hated her, and I wish she was dead, and she needed to get me out of here, and blah, blah, blah. And I used all kinds of F-bombs that she said, I never heard you say that word to me ever. And that is the person I became through alcoholism. I remember my spouse said one time that when men walk through doors of AA, they hated what they have done. And when women walk through doors of AA, they hated who they become. I don't know if that's true, but I could tell you this, that I hated, when I walked through doors of AA, I hated what I had done, and I hated who I become. And that is the person I became through alcoholism. And to this day, I don't know what that did to her. And I didn't know this back then, but she was... She's a cello player in the orchestra. She wasn't making that much money, but she's been saving money to buy cello bow. And she spent that money to get me from New York and put me to detox and trying to save my life. And I told her that I wish she was dead. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sponsorship, I've been able to make amends to her. First couple of years was super hard. And every time I tried to make amends, because obviously she was on the list, and first couple of years I tried to make amends, she had a list of things I'd done to her since I was 5 years old. And I was like, I don't think Al-Anons are teaching you much. And those were... because this is not how it's supposed to go. Anyway, my sponsor said, stop. Stop saying things to her. Stop writing letters. Just do things for her. And that's what I did. I had to go live with her because I had no place to go. And, I started doing little things for her. And eventually, our relationship got restored. And these days, she calls me or texts me on her birthday to wish me happy AA birthday. And those are one of the great events that come to pass for us. And it happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was supposed to be in detox for 3 days, but they kept me there for 10 days. I have no idea why. But they had every night at 8 o'clock, they had a happy AA people come and bring AA meeting to detox. And I didn't go to any of them because I wasn't an alcoholic. And they said, if you don't go to any of those meetings, we're not going to let you out. And I thought, oh my God. I didn't know anything about detoxes. I thought they really could really kill me. I said, that's not good. So I went one Friday night, I went to this AA meeting and two happy AA people came. His name was Jerry, and the girl's name was Deb, and Jerry passed away sober last year, and he lived in Jacksonville, Florida. Deb lives in Jacksonville. She's still sober today, and I don't know what they talked about. I'm sure they told their story, and I wasn't listening. I sat in the back and just keep waving at the front desk to let them know I was in there. After the meeting, a woman, Deb, came up to me, and she started talking to me, which I find it really annoying. And I think it's kind of rude. I don't think you should do that to people who are detoxing. I'm just saying. You could, take a notch down. She was really animated, and she was so excited, and she was, what? I don't remember things she said except two things that I still remember after 29 years, and that's that God loves you and that it works. And I know why I remember till this day, but at the time, I wanted to hit her. And then she said, call me when you get out. And so someday, my sister came and got me, and I actually called her. And she said, oh, my God, I can't believe you called. Nobody ever calls me from detox. So she said, we're going to go to a meeting. And I was like, oh, my God. What is wrong with her? Anyway, so she took me to my very first AA meeting. It was at that club that I was talking about earlier. And like I said, I didn't know how to drive, and I wouldn't take a ride from anybody because, you know, I don't need your help. And people tried to be really nice to me, but I didn't like people. So when they will say things like, oh, my God, you must be new. What's your name? And I'll say, hey, this is an anonymous program. I don't have to know your name. You don't have to know my name. Back off. That's not exactly what I said, but I can't really repeat what I said. So, and I don't know what's up with a hug. Jesus. And they always want to hug everybody. And I said, I will say, back off. I don't need a hug. And they'll say things like, what if I need one? And I'll say, don't be so needy. I said, back off. So I came to known as the hostile newcomer. As a matter of fact, like Julie said, I love newcomers, especially the angry ones. I don't really trust the happy ones. I don't know. But anyway, that was me. And I wouldn't take any help from anybody. You know, I will walk. I walk through meetings every day. And people ask me, why you come here? You hate us. You say you're not an alcoholic. You don't have God. And why you come here? And I said, because I really have no place to go. And I think my sister is planning to kill me. And if you ask me today, same question, why you come here? You hate us. You say you're not an alcoholic. You don't even have God. Why you're here? You walk here every day. And my answer is because God had walked me to every one of those meetings. And so when I was about 6 months over, Alana had told my sister that she needed to kick me out and that I have to be self-supporting. But my sister couldn't do it because she's like, well, she can't get a job and she doesn't have any money until one of the topics on Wednesday night was relapse. And my sister was like, oh, my God, what is going to happen if my sister relapses? And they said, well, first thing is going to happen, your cello is going to end up in a pawn shop. So she kicked me out. And I guess she was willing to let go of a bow, but not her cello. But anyway, I had to move to this studio apartment. I had dragged this mattress in from the street because I had no money to buy furniture. And my sponsor, I had to get a new sponsor because the first one was the one from Detox. But she was a lot. So I told her, I said, hey, I don't think this is working out. Like, you're a lot. So I'm going to get a new sponsor. And she said, oh, thank God, my prayer's been answered. So I got another sponsor. Her name was Mary Frances. And she was, like, so excited. Oh, I want to go see your new place. So she came to see my new place, and she saw the mattress on the floor. She thought I was sleeping on the floor because I was Asian. But anyway, so she's the one who took me through the steps. And I tell you, I never forget the day I did step 5 with her because I had to tell her all the things I'd done. And, you know, by selling my soul, basically. You know, I had to share the person I became and things I'd done. And she didn't judge. What she did really surprised me because she came around and she gave me a hug. And she told me she loved me. And I could not, and I would not at the time understand how anybody could love somebody that was written on that piece of paper, but I believed her. And when I was 6 months over, I get kicked out. I mean, in that apartment, and a couple of things happened. So my sister kicked me out, and then my parents, who live in South Korea, they wanted to come and see me, but my mom said, I'll go first. So my mom wanted to come and see me, so she flew all the way around the half around the world all by herself. She didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't know what sponsor was, but she wanted to meet that sponsor. She knew that was an important person. I don't know about you, but my mom was first one on my resentment list, and second one was my dad. And I hated them for how they treated me when I was young and how they neglected me, and they shipped me off to some strange school where I had to learn how to smoke cigarette and how to drink, for heaven's sakes, Christ's sakes. Anyway, all kinds of resentment. Anyway, so my mom came, and I took her to a smoky club. My God, they smoked a lot. Anyway, she sees my sponsor, my mom, you know, and just flew like 18 hours half around the world all by herself. And she starts walking over to my sponsor, and she starts sobbing. And she goes up to her, and she hugs her. And I overhear my mom say, thank you for saving my daughter's life. And the moment she said it, this rage just shot through my whole body. And only thing I could think of was, you're a sorry example of a mother. That is all I had. And that resentment was so deep and so big because she was wrong and I was just a little child and I was right, and last me next 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I became completely useless and ineffective in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't sponsor people because they fire me all the time. They said, there's no way I could do this, and because you're going to criticize me, you're going to judge me, you're going to do this. And I remember Polly holding my hand. She was literally in tears. She will say things like, I am your mother. And I said, no. You're not. And I did that to my kids. And I said, no, alcoholism did that to your kids. My mom never drank. What is her excuse? And then she will say, what you're doing is you're beating them up with your words. You may not be doing it physically, but you're doing it with the words. I intellectually heard it, but I couldn't get it through my heart. And I could not, and I would not, because I was right. And I remember people in Alcoholics, like well-meaning people, always say things like, you want to be right? You want to be happy. And I'll say, well, being right makes me happy. What about that? So that resentment almost killed me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 7 years sober. That same sponsor I was telling Carol earlier was diagnosed with lung cancer and she was dying. And her kids never forgave her. So nobody was taking care of her. And her sponsor said to take care of her. She died at home. We couldn't even put her in a hospice because we weren't blood relative. And I had the same resentment against my parents. And I'm getting madder and madder and madder. I'm 7 years sober. I hated everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous because they were so self-righteous. And my God, and they keep telling me how to do it, what to do, and I was just like, I'm dying here, and they don't understand me, you know. And I ended up in a fetal position in a hotel room 3 a.m, and that thought came to me one more time. I don't want to be drunk. I don't want to be sober. I just want to check out. But I'll do something after she dies. That was my thing. And I'll take her to stupid meetings if she wanted to go. And at the time, I'd be so resentful at her wanting to go to the stupid AA meetings with her oxygen tank, her hair, all her hair is falling out. She was coughing. And I'm just getting mad and mad. And my resentment list was longer than the first one I came with. And I remember some guy, well-meaning person in Alcoholics Anonymous said, well, maybe you should share that resentment list with your sponsor. And I said, are you kidding me? She's dying. She doesn't know what she's saying. And she goes, well, maybe she will feel useful. Anyway, so I took the idiot's suggestion. And I shared one with her. And I don't know if it was medicine or because the cancer spread to her brain. After I shared this one with her, she said, well, we're just going to have to go kill that son of a bitch. I said, all right. Anyway, I don't remember reading that in the big book. So that resemblance went back in the big book. And when she passed away, I was asked to go to a woman's retreat, which was a lot because I couldn't even go to a woman's meeting for one hour. And but I went, and that's when I heard that. That's when the shift happened. And my husband, Jim, always says, I watched you go to that retreat on Friday, and you went to that retreat as this person, and you came back a day and a half later, Sunday morning, as a completely different person. And I don't know what happened, but I do remember what I heard. And it got to me. I heard Polly say to a woman who was doing a resentment against her mother, for heaven's sakes, mothers have such a bad time in Alcoholics Anonymous, or actually the whole world. And I heard Polly say, how did your mother grow up? And Michael was sharing her story, and she said, before I tell you about my childhood, let me tell you about my mother's. And that hit me. And I always knew how they grew up, but I didn't care until that time. And they grew up terribly, my parents. And I'm not going to go into details, but it was just terrible time. And it's just a lot they went through. And I started to think about that. And what I got to do was to put myself in their shoes as best I could. And I began to understand before I was understood. And I began to love before I was loved. And began to comfort them before I was comforted. And it was like, that resentment was gone. And in 2009, so that was 7 years after that incident, so I was about 14 years old, I went back to Korea to visit my parents. And one of the last days I was there, my mom was sitting on the floor doing, folding laundry or something, because I was about to leave. I was one of the last days, and she still wanted to do my laundry. And she was folding them, and I was looking at her, and she looked so tired, and she looked so old, and I was thinking about her childhood, and I thought about our adulthood, because I watched my mother, who couldn't shed a single tear when her mother died, when her father died, when her only sibling died. But she sobbed for me when I was 6 months sober, hugging that strange woman in front of the smoky AA club. And I said to her, Mom, you look so tired. And she turned around, she took my hand, and she said, you know, I'm not proud of a lot of things I've done in my life, but what I'd regret the most is how I treated you when you were growing up. And the moment she said that, I knew I was forgiven for things I'd done and forgiven for the person I became through alcoholism. And it was as if my soul that I sold for all those drinks, I felt like a little piece of it came back. And because nothing's wasted in fourth dimension, I get to sponsor some women. They're sometimes really pain, but I sponsored this girl. She has a very similar background. That is not why I sponsor her. Nobody would sponsor her. So I'm the idiot who said yes. And she had to move to Miami for her job, and then she started complaining. People don't know how to do things in Miami. And I said, well, do something about it. And then she said, she was barely a year sober. And she said, I have an idea. I'm going to start my own conference. I said, oh, my God. But it's still going on. It's amazing what God does with bad motives. But anyway, she was a lot. Her and her husband, they weren't even married yet. And then she was pregnant, and they were like a train wreck. There was always fighting. And she got pregnant, and I said, oh, my God, you're not going to raise that kid in that household. You guys are fighting all the time, and blah, 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 blah. Nobody wants to lose. And it's not about what, I mean, it was, I would get a headache just after listening to her. And she was always leaving him every week. And he's always leaving her every week. And I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. But she wanted to put her on a conference. And she did. And first year I was there, I said, well, I'm going to go support. So I go there, and her parents were there to support, right? And her mother sees me in the hallway of the hotel, and she starts walking towards me, and she starts sobbing. And then she comes over and hugs me, and she said, thank you for saving my daughter's life. And the moment... That moment, I never forget, because I thought it was all done, right? But what God gave me, another, Julie talked about it, Jason talked, another layer of something that I completely missed when I was 6 months sober is what my dead sponsor saw. Like, I don't have kids, so I don't know how it is to have unconditional love for the kid. And I'm not a mom, so I don't know any of that. But God gave me an opportunity to see unconditional love a parent has for her or his child. And I would have completely missed it if I wasn't with you guys. And so there were, I talked about a couple of things that happened when I was 6 months over. So last year, I got a phone call from my sister who lives in Korea, and she said, you need to come home. And I said, well, can she make it till whatever? She said, no, I don't think so. And my mom's been having health issues, so she was kind of suffering anyway. So she said, so I flew there, but it takes 18 hours to get there. So when I got there, she already passed away. I got there at 5:40, and she died at 3 o'clock. And again, I was, we're trying to clean up her place and her junk. I was like, my gosh, she should be in hoarders. So many things. And I was getting mad again. I said, if you never send me over here, it would never take me 18 hours to get here. And just getting mad all over again. And I was just throwing things in the garbage can, just throwing things. And then she had all these boxes. I don't even know why she had them. They made out of like rice paper. And it was, they were like empty, just throwing it away. And this little, one of them had something in it. So I opened, and this was in there. And this is, it's a yellow chip, and it says Westside Club. And when I was 6 months sober, when my mom came to visit me, well, wanted to meet my sponsor, you guys didn't forget about that part, that we shouldn't ignore the family members. It was an open meeting. You guys remember to invite her to that open meeting. You guys had a seat for her. And she stayed for that meeting, and they gave her a visitor's chip, which was this. And she kept it for 28 years.
Wow. That's awesome.
And I don't know who orchestrated this stuff, but in Jacksonville, Florida, yellow is also 6 months chip. And when that fell out of that box, I knew that I was okay, that it was okay, that I didn't see her go. But I was there, and she knew it. So I just want to thank you guys for being here. And that thing about being right makes me happy. I do have to say that is kind of true. But there are a few things that I am so happy that I was wrong about. And I'm so happy that I was wrong about that girl that I sponsored, because she became a great mother. She just had a third child, and she's a great mother. I'm so glad that I was wrong about her and didn't have to call the child services. And I'm so happy that I was wrong about my mom. And I'm so happy that I was wrong about my dad. And I'm so happy that I was wrong about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so happy that I was wrong about you guys. And most of all, I'm so happy that I was wrong about God. So I want to thank you guys for saving me a seat that had my soul attached to it.
Thank you.